Regina Boss knew how to make an appearance. Striding on stage and swinging her prize guitar off her shoulder, she adjusted the mic and smiled out to the crowd below. As her fingers slid down the fretboard, her smoky voice poured out from the speakers like a thick fog engulfing the whole bar. Gina didn't just take the stage when she sang, she owned it, and you couldn't miss her, until the night she vanished. Just after 1 a.m., she stepped out from the bar on 11th Street, walking towards the Green Saturn Park less than 50 feet away. But somehow, she never made it home. In a window of seconds, she disappeared, leaving behind an enduring and tragic mystery. The next morning, they found her car parked just where she'd left it, but there was no sign of Gina, outside of her sheet music and guitar in the trunk, things she never would have left behind, not if she'd had a choice. The search began in earnest and quickly turned to desperation, as the utter lack of evidence baffled investigators and continues to haunt her family to this day. This is Trace Evidence, Episode 158, The Disappearance of Regina Boss. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine one of the most mysterious disappearances ever covered on Trace Evidence. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Regina Boss's life had turned a corner, and things were beginning to look up. A promotion at work, a new house in the works, three amazing kids, and a new boyfriend to boot. Then, in the midst of her rise, she would mysteriously disappear, leaving no trace behind. This is episode 158, The Disappearance of Regina Boss. The shrill electric sound echoed through the otherwise quiet home, draped in pre-dawn darkness, but no one noticed at first. Over the next half hour, the small device would emit its high-pitched chime several more times. The children, sleeping quietly in their beds, were roused by the repeating alert of their mother's pager as one number continually dialed in, sending out the electric alarm. Outside, the sun hadn't yet revealed itself, though the brightness of the stars had already begun to dim as twilight approached. The chill of fall was in the air, glass window panes slightly fogged over as the night breeze met the heat rising from the baseboards. A light bulb snapped and buzzed to life, its bright glare temporarily blinding the oldest of the three children as he sought out his mother, wondering why her pager was going off at this odd hour and more so, why she hadn't yet silenced it. Where he expected to find his mother, Regina, wrapped up in blankets, he instead found only an empty bed and the blinking light of her pager, working overtime in the dark. Looking down at the digits set against the illuminated green display, he recognized the number immediately. It was Regina's boyfriend, Michael, which raised a curious question. Why wasn't he here this morning? The previous night, his mother had gone out with Mike, and the two were supposed to return later, spending the night together in the duplex. Picking up the phone, he quickly punched in the number, assuming that maybe his mother had chosen to stay at Mike's place. But the nightmare of the truth became clear almost instantly when he was asked if his mother was home, and if not, did he have any idea of where she could be? By this time, his younger brother and sister were awake, and over the course of the next 15 minutes, a flurry of panicked calls were placed to friends, family, and neighbors, but they couldn't find their mother anywhere. A few miles across town, Mike was beginning to put the picture together, and it wasn't looking good. He quickly placed a call to Danny Krause. She was good friends with Regina, and if anyone would know where she was, it was Danny. But she didn't know, And now what had begun as a small worry and a little bit of frustration transformed into outright concern. The last time Mike had seen Regina, she was planning on stopping by the bar where she used to work to take part in an open mic night. So the most logical step was to head down there and see if they could find anything. Danny went along, and together, the two ventured down to South 11th Street. By then, the sky was beginning to change, the vast darkness of space taking on a deep blue hue, though the orange glow of streetlights still bounced off the sidewalks. That's where they found it, Regina's car, parked directly across the street from the bar where she had left it. While there didn't appear to be anything physically wrong with the vehicle, there was one detail which stood out and grabbed their attention. The trunk wasn't locked and instead hung open, a 4-inch gap of air between the latch and the body. They knew better than to touch it, and so, leaning over slightly, they peered inside and caught sight of a dim reflection. It was a guitar, Regina's prized possession, something she would never have left behind. In that moment, they both knew something was very wrong. Regina Marie Rapp was born on Wednesday, November 4th, 1959, in Lincoln, Nebraska, to parents Carlos and Dee. The third-born child in a family which would go on to be comprised of 7 siblings, Regina, or Gina as she is frequently called, stood out from the crowd of kids with her own unique outgoing and unrestrained personality. She quickly developed a strong will, which would only grow tougher throughout her life, friends and family playfully describing her as everything from unflappable to hard-headed and stubborn. Both were labels she wore like a badge of honor with her signature smile. Gina was outgoing, never shy to speak up for herself or anyone else, be they at school, play, or work. Growing up in a family with 7 siblings often meant there wasn't a lot of time alone, so the family spent their time together. As Gina's older sister Janelle later explained to the Lincoln Star Journal, there wasn't a lot of money to go around, but they found a way to have fun, and much of that came out of music. It was a family affair. Their father was a preacher who would often fill in at churches throughout the area, bringing along his 7 kids who would sing the gospel. Their grandfather played violin, their grandmother, piano. They carried this home with them, where it wasn't uncommon for everyone to sit down together to sing songs, from hymns to songs they'd heard on the radio. According to Janelle, since they couldn't really afford to go on extravagant vacations or even frugal ones, it wasn't uncommon for everyone to pack into the family station wagon where they'd drive out to the country singing all the way. Each of the kids had their own relationship with music, but for Gina and Janelle, it was a love they'd carry and develop for the rest of their lives. For Gina, though, her artistic ability stretched into almost every avenue. From sculpting to painting, clothing design, and hairstyling, it seemed she had the ability to create amazing pieces no matter the medium. And while music may have grabbed her heart, the others were never far from reach, whether she was doing a sister's hair for the prom or stitching together a Halloween costume from her own seemingly endless imagination. She went on to attend Mickle Middle School, just a few blocks from the family home, before moving on to Northeast High School, where the majority of her siblings had and would later attend. A member of the graduating class of 78, Gina hadn't exactly locked in what she planned to do with her future, but she would follow in her older sister's footsteps, attending university in Minneapolis, though she wouldn't finish up a degree program. She'd eventually harness one of her artistic talents, gaining a license in cosmetology from the College of Hair Design, though her career path was never set in stone, and throughout her late teens and early 20s, she'd work any number of odd jobs. Moving into her 20s, Gina's interest in music began turning more towards guitar, with singer-songwriter aspirations. Her guitar would soon become inseparable from her, something that went almost everywhere with her to the point that it became a running joke in the family. Gina, humorously, gave the guitar a name as though it was a child, calling it Harley. She was notoriously protective of the instrument, with friends and family noting that wherever she went, whether it was out to dinner or to meet up with friends, if the guitar was with her, it was coming inside. She never left it in her car, feeling it wasn't safe, and she simply couldn't accept the possibility of it being damaged or stolen. In the spring of 1983, when she was 23 years old, Gina married Thomas Williams in a service held at the First German Congregational Church, less than a 15-minute drive from the home she grew up in. The newlyweds would take a trip to Kansas City after the wedding and then return to Lincoln, where they'd settle into a small, two-bedroom home on Hitchcock Street. Over the course of the next 6 years, the couple would welcome three children, two sons followed by a daughter. Unfortunately, while Gina and Thomas deeply loved their kids, their own relationship began to deteriorate, and they would ultimately divorce, with it being finalized in August of 1991. Over the next few years, Gina and Tom maintained an amicable relationship and co-parented successfully. 5 years later, on June 9, 1996, Gina, now 36, married 40-year-old David Boss. This would be a short-lived marriage, though the separation and ultimately divorce a few years later wouldn't come out of the result of malice or animus, but came rather as a mutual agreement that, while they loved one another, they weren't necessarily in love with one another. Though the couple split, they maintained close contact and spoke frequently. They cared about each other and wanted the best for one another, and they were smart enough to know that what worked best for one didn't necessarily work for the other. They were so close, in fact, that David would end up being one of the last people to see Gina before she mysteriously vanished. According to several family members, when speaking to the Lincoln Journal Star, the summer of 2000 was a difficult one for Gina, and it had several ups and downs. She began to exhibit symptoms of depression and was placed on an antidepressant. The previous few years had been hard financially, and Gina struggled a bit, but no matter what, she was dedicated to doing whatever she had to take care of and provide for her kids. She picked up a job at a local bar, Duggan's Pub, and for several years she'd worked there on and off, trying to pick up extra money when she could. However, she was still only making it by the skin of her teeth. She was placed on a list for Habitat for Humanity to receive a proper home to raise her kids in. Coming out of the summer and going into the fall, though, things had begun to improve. In late July, she began dating Michael Johnson, and it was going well. She picked up a job at Kinko's, and in October, she was promoted to the position of assistant manager, which really changed things for her. This meant better income, a solid position, and the chance to rise even higher. Then she received the news that her name had reached the top of the list, and Habitat for Humanity was going to be building a home for her and the kids on West C Street. After several years of difficult times, everything was starting to look up. Unfortunately, during this rising time, Gina would disappear without a trace. It all began on the evening of Monday, October 16th, 2000. It was a busy day for Gina with a lot of different things going on. One of her sons was returning from a trip to Disney World, which he'd taken with his grandmother. It was also her oldest son's birthday, as well as being the same day that a baby shower was being thrown for a friend. The party was to be held at Duggan's Pub, Gina's former workplace, and while she didn't work there at the time, she was a frequent visitor and knew the crowd well. Her plan was pretty simple. Head down to the bar with Mike, celebrate the shower, and then come back home and spend the rest of the night with the kids. However, things changed and Gina's original plan didn't go off as she'd intended. She arrived at the bar at approximately 5:30 p.m. The baby shower was scheduled to take place around 6. While that went off without a hitch, Gina had several conversations with friends who asked her if she was planning to participate in open mic night later in the evening. At first, she explained, she wanted to go home and spend time with the kids, so that likely wasn't going to happen. But eventually, she was convinced to swing by for a little bit. She'd be able to come late, after the kids had gone to bed, and not miss out on the open mic. So if she was still in the mood and not too tired, she told friends, she'd come back and play a few songs. At the time, Gina was living just a few miles away to the east on Lenox Avenue. Arriving home where Mike was waiting for her, she spent time talking to the kids, celebrating a birthday and discussing the Disney trip. By all accounts, it was a good night, with a lot of laughter and, of course, a few songs. While the exact time isn't noted, if it's in fact known, Janelle would later state that Gina and Mike left the home sometime between 10 and 11 p.m., with plans of returning to Duggan's for the open mic. Gina packed both her sheet music and her beloved guitar, and she and Mike set off in her light green 1997 Saturn. Something went wrong along the way, though, as Mike would later explain. the couple got into an argument about something minor, and he didn't want to go to the bar. Or perhaps the argument was about him not wanting to go to the bar. Instead, Gina agreed to drop him off at his apartment, approximately 10 blocks from the bar, and she told him she'd pick him up when she was done and they'd go back to her place. Duggan's pub was located at 440 South 11th Street, right at the intersection of K Street. At the time, there were parallel parking spaces directly across from the bar, and that's where Gina ended up parking, striding into the building with her guitar on her shoulder and her music in hand. According to everyone present, Gina seemed to be in a very good mood and was chatting with a lot of different people. Close friend Danny Krause later explained to the Star Journal, quote, "She was ecstatic. She was finally management. She was finally able to make something of herself. She was getting a home. She was the best I had ever seen her," end quote. At the bar, one of the first people Gina ran into was David, her ex-husband. The two chatted and caught up, with David later saying that she seemed to be in a really good mood and he was happy for her. David left a little while later at approximately 11 p.m. When Gina took the stage and played a few ballads, singing in her signature throaty voice, the crowd loved it. After the performance, she'd come back on stage to sing backup for a band with whom she was friends. At one point, she had a conversation about laying down some tracks for an album and was really excited about that possibility, looking forward to stepping into a studio. Gina stayed at the bar until around closing time, reportedly exiting the building and crossing the street towards her car at about 1 a.m. The last sightings of Gina place her either near the exit of the bar or walking across the street. She was supposed to head back to Mike's place and pick him up, but she'd never make it there. And while waiting, Mike fell asleep. Waking up a few hours later, around 2 or 3 a.m., he just assumed Gina was tired and decided to go home. He dialed the number of her pager, but he never got a call back. Unbeknownst to anyone, Gina had forgotten her pager at home. Whether she had left it there purposefully or just lost track of it, no one really knows. In the morning, when Mike still hadn't heard from Gina, he began paging her again and again. Finally, the sound of the pager woke the kids, and it was at this time that they spoke to Mike and realized their mother was missing. This immediately sent them into a panic because this wasn't her typical behavior. Gina had never failed to come home before, not without at least a call to explain why. When multiple calls failed to narrow down a location, Mike and Danny got together and headed down to 11th Street to see if maybe she'd had car trouble, gone home with a friend, or worse yet, was injured or unable to get to a phone. No one dared to think that she could be missing. As dedicated as she was to her kids, Gina wouldn't just run off, and if someone tried to grab her, she'd put up a hell of a fight. Not long after 6 a.m., before the sun had risen, Mike and Danny arrived at the bar, and there, staring out at them from the side of the road beneath a row of trees, was Gina's light green 1997 Saturn. A quick scan of the vehicle didn't show any outward indications of damage or trouble. There wasn't any blood on the sidewalk or pavement, no purse on the ground or items scattered. It looked as if Gina had either gotten to her car and then vanished or had never made it to the car. That was until they noticed the trunk. It was unlocked and slightly open, a 4-inch space between the latch and the lock. Looking inside, the two saw the sheet music Gina had used the night before, as well as her prized guitar. It appeared as though she, or perhaps someone else, had placed the items in the trunk and then been interrupted before they could close it all the way. Both immediately knew something was terribly wrong, as Danny would later tell the Star Journal, quote, "Her music and her guitar are an appendage to her. They're like her fourth child. Gina would never, ever leave her guitar unsecured. Ever." End quote. By the time the Lincoln police were called, Gina hadn't been seen for approximately 5 hours. The call came into 911 operators at 6:38 a.m. Investigators were met with a difficult challenge. They were 5 hours behind Gina. There was no evidence at the scene to suggest a struggle had occurred, and they had no earthly idea of where to even begin looking. Initial interviews with Gina's friends and family led police to believe that this was a serious matter, not one where she'd simply gone off and failed to tell anyone. As Janelle later explained, quote, "My sister loves and adores her children and would never take off. She would not worry her family this way. End quote. A search of the area was launched with officers and volunteers on foot, as well as cadaver dogs, though it appeared that wherever Gina was, she was not within any proximity of her car, the bar, or that area of Lincoln. From the first moment of the investigation, they classified her disappearance as missing under extremely suspicious circumstances. One of their first moves was to try and track down everyone who had been at the bar the previous night to find out if they'd seen or heard anything strange. Reportedly, by closing time when Gina left, there were less than 20 people still present. For the most part, patrons remembered seeing her, but little beyond that. A few people told police they'd seen her standing next to the exit, but they hadn't seen her leave. At the time, it's been said, the bar had a surveillance system both outside and in, but it wasn't operational, so any footage that might have been captured was lost. An employee of the bar, not named but noted as being a 61-year-old male, told police that he left around the same time Gina did. According to the Star Journal, as he left, he saw Gina crossing the street towards her car with her guitar. He turned, heading a different direction with his back to Gina, so he didn't actually see her getting to the car. However, he told police he hadn't heard anything strange, nor had he seen anything wrong. The street was quiet, and as far as he knew, Gina was fine. Bar owner Jack Gross later explained, quote, "She was one lane away. He didn't hear any screams. He didn't hear anything." End quote. Several other people were still at the bar around this time. The band which had performed was going in and out, removing their equipment. When questioned by investigators, not a single person reported seeing or hearing anything out of the ordinary. It was truly bizarre for police. How does a woman disappear less than 30 feet from a bar where people are moving in and out and not a single person sees anything? While Gina's car was taken and processed for evidence, nothing was found. No out-of-place fingerprints, no drops of blood, strange hairs and fibers. Curiously, while Gina's guitar and music were in the trunk, her purse was never located. Other than the fact that Gina was clearly missing, police didn't have a single piece of solid evidence to suggest what might have happened. Initially, early reports in the media stated that Gina had been seen by witnesses speaking with two unidentified men near her car in the moments before she vanished. However, that account has never been verified by police, who explained they weren't exactly sure where that report came from. When asked about potential suspects, Captain Gary Engel of the Lincoln Police Department told the Journal Star, quote, "We have a couple of people that were running down to see what they have to say about her. I wouldn't call them suspects." End quote. While investigators were working to try and establish what exactly happened, Gina's family began arriving in Nebraska from their different places around the country. Their focus was to get attention on the case, as much of it as possible, and to get Gina's face out there everywhere. They knew she would never walk away from her kids, nor would she abandon the job she was so excited to get promoted at. In hopes of pulling in tips, leads, and sightings, they began posting flyers bearing Gina's image, description, and the details surrounding her disappearance. They printed up t-shirts with her photo, selling them to try and raise money for a reward fund. Inside of the first week, police had interviewed just over a dozen people about Gina, and the family had posted more than 10,000 flyers. Unfortunately, Gina's case was growing cold almost from the moment police were notified. As Detective Greg Sorensen later told the Star Journal, quote, "Anybody could be a suspect at this time, because we have absolutely no idea what happened." End quote. In the beginning, police received several calls with potential tips, though none of them led to anything concrete. Soon, a vicious cycle of misinformation developed, with people hearing rumors, reporting them as fact, and then those reports fueling additional calls about the same already investigated rumors. There were tips that Gina had taken drugs and overdosed, at which time the person she was with disposed of her body. Others claimed she'd become hooked on methamphetamine and was living on the streets. Perhaps the most outlandish rumors circled around Mexican drug cartels, where it was suggested that Gina had been killed because she'd seen something she wasn't supposed to. What made these claims so bizarre was that Gina didn't mess with street drugs. She had medication for her depression, and she knew better than to mix them. Beyond that, Janelle later explained that Gina had never been a pro-drug person and had always been opposed to their use. Part of the problem was that many of the tips police received came from people who were arrested for drug offenses and were looking to trade information to cut a deal. For investigators, they were more grounded in their approach, which was a grim but likely one. They were pretty clear about it. Within a few weeks, they believed Gina had likely been killed the night she vanished. Detective Sorensen later stated, quote, "We don't have enough information to say who killed Gina, but I don't think she just walked away," end quote. Early on, police focused on those close to Gina. They questioned Michael, her ex-husband David, and even her first husband. While the details of these interviews haven't been released, at no time has any of them been listed or publicly acknowledged as a person of interest, nor were there reportedly any major issues between the men and Gina. Mike was forthcoming with police and told them that he and Gina had argued that night. He was upfront about it, and since she was planning to pick him up after the bar, it didn't sound like the kind of dispute that would lead to violence. Michael, later interviewed by Dateline, explained, quote, "I was really wiped out by the whole thing. I was really in love with her. I couldn't really function. It was very difficult to deal with," end quote. Janelle, when appearing on the podcast Unfound, was asked about Michael and stated that she didn't think he had been involved, noting that he seemed pretty upset by the disappearance. She also said that she believed Michael had taken a polygraph and passed, though police have never commented on any of the people they questioned. For a missing woman, it appeared, there was a dramatic lack of potential suspects. The community responded, showing a tremendous outpouring of support for Gina's family in the weeks following her disappearance, helping with fundraisers, putting up flyers, and sending food and meals to them. In early November, 2 weeks after Gina disappeared, friends who had organized a reward fund for information regarding Tina McMenamin, an 18-year-old University of Nebraska-Lincoln student who was sexually assaulted and murdered, donated some of the money they'd gathered towards a reward for information regarding Gina. That same month, Lamar Outdoor Billboards donated space on 12 billboards to advertise the details of Gina's case, and her family organized a fundraising concert to both bring awareness to the case and help gather money for increasing the reward. Unfortunately, despite these efforts and increased interviews and investigation by police, leads were beginning to dry up by the end of the month. With the holidays coming, Gina's family struggled to confront this dark reality. Gina's 41st birthday came and went with no new information. Thanksgiving left an empty seat at the table, and as Christmas approached, the desperation for information grew stronger. Gina's parents, in hopes of keeping themselves distracted, volunteered their time at a homeless shelter, saying Gina would have approved. When speaking to the Star Journal, Gina's father, Carl, tried to explain how difficult it was, but the words were hard to come by. He said, quote, "You feel like a part of you is missing because a part of you is. I don't know how to explain it. All you're trying to do, it's probably not enough. I just wish we knew something else that we could do that would bring her back. We're thinking the best Christmas present would be to find Gina," end quote. Part of Gina's family's approach was also to shelter her children, to protect them from the harsh truth. They worked hard to keep media coverage out of the house and away from their view. They knew Gina was missing, they knew police were searching for her, but they knew few other pertinent details. As Gina's mother, Dee, explained, quote, "I don't think they've seen the newspapers. We haven't said a whole lot other than we're still looking. We haven't stopped looking," end quote. The children split their time between their father and their maternal grandparents and didn't wish to discuss the case with anyone other than each other, gathering together in what their paternal grandmother called private huddles. A heavy blow came when Habitat for Humanity granted the home which had been designated for Gina to the next family on the list, though they assured the family that should Gina return, her name would automatically be placed at the top. The year of 2000 came to a bitter end for all involved as the clock ticked down to midnight, launching the new year. No one knew where Gina was, nor what might have happened to her. Police told the family that the investigation was still active and open, but they hadn't managed to develop any solid leads, and those tips which they did run down had either been false or just led to dead ends. None of the pieces fit, none of the case made sense, and while we all know people don't just fall off the face of the earth, the utter lack of evidence failed to present any solid alternative theories outside of the belief that Gina had likely been abducted and killed by an unknown assailant. Over the course of the next year, Gina's family continued working hard to keep her name in the spotlight, but stories about her case were coming out less and less. Details about the disappearance remained nearly blank, and the public started to move on with their lives, but the family could not and would not forget. They tried to get Gina's story covered on Unsolved Mysteries, but interestingly, we're told there wasn't enough information for the segment. They went to daytime talk shows, and while they came close a few times, the horrible attacks of September 11th took precedence. As Janelle put it, it's hard to get people to invest in a missing woman when so many thousands have been lost in the blink of an eye. In hopes of drumming up some information, Gina's family gathered for a candlelight vigil on October 17th, 1 year to the day since Gina's disappearance. The family, with friends and locals, stood across the street from Duggan's where Gina had been parked and sang songs, handed out flyers, and collected donations. Despite all of the efforts, Gina's case continued to grow cold, but police firmly believed there was someone out there who had information, someone who, for whatever reason, had chosen not to come forward yet. Soon, days turned to weeks, weeks to months, and months to years. Over those years, police continued working. 2 years in, they'd compiled over 500 reports and traveled to different states looking for connections to similar crimes and following up on tips they'd received. Just 2 years after that, there were more than 700 reports, filling several file boxes with all the tips and leads they'd tracked down. Yet nowhere in those papers could they find the answers, or at least, not any answers they could share, but there was definitely a handful of people being looked at closely, and at least one being tracked much more closely than the rest. More than 20 psychics called in, giving their beliefs about what happened, though the details were often vague and could apply to almost any case. As Janelle later told the Journal Star, quote, "They all have different ideas, but nothing concrete or anything that's pointed us in any directions. We don't think they couldn't help, but they haven't helped. It's not enough to follow up on. I take it with a grain of salt, but I write it down and try to look and see if anything is a common thread, but really there hasn't been any." End quote. In 2003, Janelle began the organization 411 Gina, which over the years has contributed to the search for hundreds of missing persons, and in some cases resulted in them being located. She began touring, playing music shows to raise awareness, not just for her sister, but for the hundreds of thousands of other missing persons out there. Through her activism, she's connected with many families who have suffered and struggled through the same horror that she and her family have. In 2006, she organized the annual Squeaky Wheel Tour, designed to expand on raising awareness for Gina and other cases. When asked about how much she's done to try and locate Gina, Janelle explained, quote, "When Gina disappeared, I realized that it was very difficult to get attention for her. She had no story. She just vanished. We needed to do something to make a bigger noise. I wanted something that screams louder. The odds are slim for finding her alive, but there's more than likely somebody out there who knows exactly what happened to her. Sometimes it's taken 10 years, but someone speaks. Maybe they've divorced the suspect or there's somebody in jail. Sometimes people find Jesus and say they've got to confess." End quote. 3 years later, in 2009, the family marked what should have been a joyous occasion, Gina's 50th birthday, by performing and singing together to honor her in a way they believe she would appreciate. Janelle reiterated how they couldn't stop searching, not until they found the truth, telling the Journal Star, quote, "What if she were out there somewhere and we stopped looking?" End quote. 6 years later, in 2015, the family held a memorial for Gina, though they noted this didn't mean they were giving up the search. In fact, they were more dedicated to finding the truth than ever. As part of the memorial, a metal plaque bearing the image of a sunflower was attached to a tree near where Gina's car had been found. It reads, "Regina Gina Rapp Williams Boss was last seen here October 17th, 2000. As for their part, the Lincoln police stated that the case was still being actively investigated, but nothing new had been developed. However, they did follow up on any tips they received, and they were still receiving tips. Detective Sorensen retired from the police department after 40 years. Gina's case was turned over to Ken Kazol, a 38-year veteran with a focused determination to solve it once and for all. In 2016, he spoke to the Star Journal and explained that there are thousands of digitized files concerning Gina's disappearance, though he reiterated that someone out there holds the answers. Someone out there can help them bring justice to Gina's killer, and hopefully some sense of closure to her family. That someone just needs to pick up a phone. In 2019, former Detective Sorensen was hired on by the prosecutor's office as a special investigator, and one of the cases under his domain is that of Gina Boss. When asked about the case and where it stands some 19 years later, he explained, quote, "It's still listed as a missing persons case, but we're treating it as a homicide. There are persons of interest who are considered suspects. Hopefully, we'll get enough information, or possibly the person will feel bad enough to call me." End quote. Lincoln has changed a lot over the past 21 years. Duggan's Pub is long since gone, replaced by a restaurant with a different edifice. The parking space where Gina's car was found has been adjusted, transformed from parallel to angled, though the tree bearing her plaque still stands. No matter how much the city changes, Gina remains a constant in the minds of police and those who lived there when she vanished. While investigators have been very precise about the fact that they don't wish to share information that could jeopardize the case, Detective Sorensen spoke to Dateline NBC and made perhaps one of the most pointed, sharp, and direct statements regarding Gina's disappearance and the person he believes is responsible. Sorensen, when asked about a suspect, replied, quote, "We don't have enough probable cause to arrest somebody, but do I think I know who killed her? Yes. There is no way she could be forcibly taken off the street in front of all those people that night by a stranger. I think she knew who her assailant was. He knows that I know, but he also knows that I don't have enough to arrest him yet. But if I find a body, maybe I do. Maybe that's the only thing I'm lacking at this point. I just keep going. Sooner or later, maybe I'll get lucky. Maybe he'll have a change of heart. Maybe he'll come talk to me. I don't know, but I'll continue to talk to him." End quote. When last seen, Regina Marie Rapp Williams Boss was described as being a white female with auburn hair and brown eyes, standing 5 feet 6 inches tall and weighing 105 pounds. Gina has facial freckles and a tattoo of a small yellow rose on her back. Her ears are pierced multiple times, and she wears wire-frame glasses or contact lenses. When last seen, Gina was wearing a black short-sleeve shirt, fitted black pants, and black ankle boots. She was last seen in the vicinity of Duggan's Pub, 440 South 11th Street, Lincoln, Nebraska, at approximately 1 a.m. on Tuesday, October 17th, 2000. Gina was 40 years old when she vanished, and if alive today, she would be turning 62 this November. 21 years is a long time to wait for answers, to not know what became of a sister, daughter, and mother. A family of 7 siblings has lost one, and there's nothing which can fill the hole that stands in her place. 3 children, all these years later, are adults who never got to share some of the brightest experiences in their lives with the mother who never came home. While time continues to move on and lives must move forward, Gina's never been forgotten, and the drive to find her, to deliver justice, and to see her killer arrested and charged is stronger than it's ever been. But it hasn't been without its difficulties. As strong as they are, Gina's family feels the weight of her absence and the haunting veil of unknowing. As Janelle herself explained to ABC News just this past October.
Because every day, person who knows, we wonder if we've looked hard enough. We wonder if we've done enough. We wonder what else we could possibly do, or if she's suffering, or, you know, we just don't know.
Is there something standing in the way of your happiness? Something that stops you from achieving your goals? I've been there more times than I'd like to admit, feeling the weight of everything just crushing down on me. There's nothing wrong with admitting that you could use some help, and thankfully there's a great service available to you, BetterHelp. BetterHelp assesses your needs and provides you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can easily connect to a safe, secure, and private online environment to discuss the things that are weighing you down. BetterHelp isn't a crisis line, it's not self-help. It's professional counseling done conveniently and securely online. You can message your counselor anytime and receive thoughtful responses. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions right from the comfort of your own home. No uncomfortable waiting rooms. One thing I really love about BetterHelp is the affordability. It's less costly than traditional offline counseling, and they even offer financial aid. Find the help you need, not just what's offered by counselors close to home. BetterHelp provides licensed professional counselors who specialize in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, and so much more. Most importantly, with BetterHelp, everything you share is confidential and counseling is offered securely and conveniently. So many people are using BetterHelp that they've been recruiting additional counselors across all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/trace. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/trace. Have you ever wished you had a pocket-sized guide to help you sleep, focus, act, and be better? Well, there is one, and if you have 10 minutes, Headspace can change your life. Headspace is your daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditations in an easy-to-use app. Headspace is one of the only meditation apps advancing the field of mindfulness and meditation through clinically validated research. So whatever the situation, Headspace can really help you feel better. Overwhelmed? Headspace has a 3-minute SOS meditation just for you. Need help falling asleep? Headspace has wind-down sessions their members swear by. And for parents, Headspace even has morning meditations you can do with your kids. Headspace's approach to mindfulness can reduce stress, improve sleep, boost focus, and increase your overall sense of well-being. My brain never stops, and it can be difficult for me to take the time I need to slow everything down. Thanks to Headspace, I don't have to spend a lot of time trying to figure out the best approach. I love how the infographics guide me along, and with session timers, I never lose out on a minute. Plus, with their email reminders, I never forget to take the time I need. All I have to do is tap the play button and I'm off. Just 10 minutes later, I'm ready to take on the world again. Headspace is backed by 25 published studies on its benefits, 600,000 five-star reviews, and over 60 million downloads. Headspace makes it easy for you to build a life-changing meditation practice with mindfulness that works for you, on your schedule, anytime, anywhere. You deserve to feel happier, and Headspace is meditation made simple. Go to headspace.com/trace. That's headspace.com/trace for a free 1-month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal offered right now. Head to headspace.com/trace today. Regina Marie Boss was beginning to come around the curve. After a long and difficult summer, her life was coming back together. She had a home being built for her family, she was promoted at work, and she was excited about moving up the ladder, and her new relationship was going well. She was happy. For the first time in a long time, there was nothing pulling her down, and the road, which had been such a vast uphill climb, was beginning to level out. Then, in the midst of her rise, she vanishes in one of the most confusing and inexplicable ways we've ever looked at. This isn't a situation where someone driving through a sparsely populated area disappears, leaving only their car behind. It isn't someone who went home to an empty apartment and vanished from inside, leaving no trace. This is a woman who was known at a bar, performed twice that night, knew many of the people who were present, and who had previously worked there. She stood out in a crowd, grabbed attention, and was the type of person that even if someone didn't know her, they remembered her. In this case, almost everyone at the bar that night remembered seeing her. It's just that no one saw her more than a few minutes after she left. We have witnesses who saw her lingering by the door, at least one who saw her crossing the street towards her car. In the window of time that Gina disappeared, there were people coming in and out, taking their band equipment. The employees were there. They had to lock up after everything had been cleared out. Yet no one saw anything. No one heard anything. And when police arrived to investigate, there's no trail at all. A grid search yields no results. Cadaver dogs can't pick up on a scent. All they really know is that Gina made it as far as her car. But even the question of her guitar and music in the trunk doesn't have a 100% confirmed answer. Did Gina put them in the trunk and get accosted before she could close it? Did someone else put them in the trunk and chose not to latch it because they didn't want to make a loud sound that might draw attention? Or was Gina grabbed somewhere between the trunk and the driver's side door and, during the struggle, hit the button on her key fob that unlatched the trunk? The trunk itself could have been used as a diversion as well. Maybe someone asked her to open the trunk for one reason or another, and when she turned to do so, she's taken. I suppose the question that lingers at the heart of all of it is, how does someone vanish from a busy street corner with a handful of people right across the way and no one notices anything? The fact of the matter is, there aren't a myriad of possibilities here. There's not a ton of different scenarios that could have went down. There's a finite set of circumstances which could have led to Gina's disappearance. And when you break it all down, there's two theories that are considered the most likely. Either Gina was abducted by a stranger, or perhaps more than one, who managed to grab the mother of three, pull her into a vehicle, and drive away in a matter of seconds, before anyone even knew what happened. Or Gina was targeted by someone she knew, someone she trusted, someone who either pulled her to the side to talk and then struck, or perhaps convinced her to come along or get into their car for a quick ride or a chat, and once she was in, there was no getting out. We'll begin with the stranger scenario because at the end of the day, this is the account for which there's the least amount of supporting information. It's not at this time a possibility that can be completely ruled out, at least not with the information which has been shared publicly. Though police seem to think it's highly unlikely, they have a specific person in mind, but they also know a lot more than we do, so we'll save that discussion for the second theory. In the interest of being thorough, let's look at a stranger abduction. There's a couple of different ways this could have happened. Either completely at random, people in the area, driving down the street, hanging out near the bar, they see a woman by herself in the middle of the night and decide she's an easy target. Or maybe someone or a group of people who were at the bar that night focused in on her for one reason or another. Maybe she chatted with someone and they became transfixed. Maybe she didn't chat with someone and they took it as an affront. In all reality, the motive behind a stranger situation could be profound or it could just be a whim, and sadly, that's why random crimes are so notoriously difficult to crack. Your search for motive, means, and opportunity is hindered when that first choice, motive, doesn't necessarily exist outside of someone just wanted to do something terrible. Given the time frame that we have, whoever would have done this didn't have a lot of time to pull it off. With people going in and out of the bar loading equipment, with cars passing by and the potential of employees walking home or people out on the street, it's a high-risk situation. Anyone could have seen something. A suspect, a vehicle, the abduction itself. We know that no one did, or at least there's no one who has admitted to seeing anything. But that doesn't mean it couldn't have been a pretty blatant act. A lot of abductions occur so rapidly that no one even sees it coming. How many times has a child vanished from a park when a parent looked away for 20 seconds, or a person disappears from the street and everyone says they were just standing there a second ago? In most cases, I assume people underestimate the time. 20 seconds may have been 2 minutes. Just standing here a moment ago could have been 5 minutes. But here, this had to occur between the time people leaving the bar cleared the street and before the people packing up their equipment got into their own vehicles and drove off. The most likely scenario, if it was a stranger abduction, goes one of two ways for me. Either someone approached Gina, perhaps was even waiting outside for her and started talking to get her distracted. It could have been a question about her music or an attempt to compliment her. Hell, it could have been as simple as, I'm so-and-so from XYZ Records and I'd like to talk to you about cutting some tracks. At the time, maybe, when she turns to close the trunk, the assailant either strikes her with something, knocking her unconscious, uses some kind of item or chemical to either knock her out or limit her ability to fight back. She's then taken to a waiting vehicle, or if more than one person is in fact involved, perhaps without even knocking her out, she's grabbed, a car stops, she's thrown in, and they take off. I know Gina was a fighter. I know she would have made a scene and fought hard. Her whole family's made that clear. But I also know she was 5 feet 6 inches tall and 105 pounds, And if you've got a guy who's a good 6 feet, 225, and he's got experience in controlling people, he's going to be able to subdue her pretty quickly. And by the time she's able to do anything, she's already in a car. There's also the possibility someone could have brandished a weapon and told her to stay quiet or they'd kill her, at which time she's forced into a vehicle. Most advice you'll find online about potential abductions focuses completely on the moment it occurs. Call for help, fight, struggle, get attention, run, grab anything you can use as a weapon, etc. However, the complexion changes once you've lost the battle and the abductor has the upper hand. At that time, most guides advise cooperation and doing what you have to stay alive, while trying to memorize everything you can about the vehicle, the suspects, where you're going, what they're saying, what they sound like, smell like. For me personally, I believe that once an abductor has you under their control, they're liable to do anything, and you're likely not going to make it back. So I've always lived my life believing I'd never go along. Obviously, if I'm physically overpowered, there's little I can do. But if someone pulled a gun and told me to get in the car, I'm just going to run for it. I'd rather be shot on the street where hopefully someone's going to hear it, see what's happening, or call the police, as opposed to being brought to some dark room in the middle of nowhere where no one's ever going to find me. But most places advise against that. Again, that's my own personal choice. We've seen situations where people escaped or were released, but if I'm going to be killed or harmed, I'm going to make sure that you do it on my terms, not yours. But I digress. Many studies have gone into abductions, although frankly they tend to focus primarily on child abductions, which I understand, but it's also important to have data that shows adults what to do should they be faced with a situation. On average, most abductions occur in less than 90 seconds. That's a minute and a half at the maximum. However, we've also seen cases where it's organized, planned, involves more than one person, and in those cases where someone's grabbed, thrown into a car, and taken quickly, it can happen in as little as 10 seconds. Looking at where Gina was parked, a major intersection was just 20 or so feet away. Perhaps one person talks to Gina, a car pulls up at the stoplight. Before she even knows what's happening, she's being shoved into the back seat or the trunk. It happens so fast. Just think of how many disappearances we've dug into on this show alone, and many of them happened in seconds. The problem comes in when we look at what else we know about the situation. There's people around. Would a random abductor risk it given those circumstances? There's no sign of a struggle, nothing dropped on the ground. Gina's purse has never been found, which either means she had it slung over her shoulder and it went with her, or the abductor made sure to take that too. I suppose there's also the possibility it could have dropped and in the 5 hours between her disappearance and the call to police, someone found it on the street and took it. However, the sheer lack of any physical evidence at the scene seems to suggest this wasn't a massive struggle. The problem is, it didn't have to be. Imagine someone standing with their back to the curb facing the street, talking to Gina while she's at her trunk. A car pulls up next to them, someone swings the door open, and the guy with his back to the curb shoves her right in and leaps in beside her. By the time the door closes, the car's already a block away. I think we also have to take Gina's state of mind into consideration that night. She's riding high, feeling good. She may have been a little more distracted than usual, as she was having a good time that night. Things were coming together in her life. The band she sang with inside wanted to work with her again. There was discussion of going into a studio to work on songs. She may have stepped out of that bar walking on clouds, and even a half a second's hesitance could have meant the difference between escape or abduction, deceit or perception. Also, it's never been mentioned in any reports, but I do wonder if she had any drinks that night. She'd been there for 2.5 to 3 hours. It's not out of the question she could have had a drink or two, and that could have also impacted her judgment or slowed her reaction time. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying she was the type to get wasted, but a little buzz makes a difference too. I wonder if police know that answer. I wonder if Gina had any drinks or if she walked out of there straight as an arrow. I know she didn't do drugs, but there's nothing wrong with a woman having a few drinks at an open mic. What about the possibility that someone could have slipped something into one of those drinks? Not completely out of the question either, sadly. Looking at the crime statistics, this isn't a great section of Lincoln. K Street, which runs east to west, meets 11th South, right at the border between two different areas on the crime index, north of K being listed as dangerous, and south of K being listed as most dangerous. Now, I don't know what this area was like back in 2000, but based on statements from friends and family, even at that time, it was sort of a borderline section of the city. Not the kind of place where you're always looking over your shoulder, but maybe one where you're a little more vigilant. So, could Gina have been targeted completely at random? Sure, it's not something I'm going to dismiss as ludicrous or completely out of touch with reality. However, is that the most likely scenario as to what happened here? Well, I tend to agree with investigators that it's a lot more plausible that whoever took Gina that night knew her, and more importantly, she knew them. It would be someone she felt safe with, comfortable with, someone who she didn't think she had to worry about. So let's move into that final theory. Gina was a lifetime resident of Lincoln. At 40 years old, she'd lived in the area her whole life and she knew it well. She'd worked several different jobs in the years before her disappearance, one of which was actually at Duggan's Pub. She performed at open mic nights. She performed with bands. She knew a lot of different people from a lot of different walks of life. According to her family, she stood out. When she showed up, you knew she was there. And friends referred to her as a stage junkie, someone who just couldn't help but get up in front of a crowd whenever she had the opportunity. As anyone who's lived in the same town most of their life knows, you get to know people all around. You make friends, sometimes with good people, sometimes with people who turn out to be a bit sketchy. You work with honest folks. You work with people who are up to no good. Gina seemed to be the type who, while not naive, understood living a life that was outside of the norm. She wasn't judgmental. She had room in her heart for everyone. And sadly, it's often people who can relate to anyone who end up being targeted by someone they think feels the same way about them. I think if we look at the scene and what we know, it's most likely Gina went along with the person who abducted her. Her own sister, Janelle, has said that it's her belief someone Gina knew asked her to chat for a minute or come sit in the car and talk. It was a bit cold out that night, and something went wrong at that point. Maybe it was a guy she used to date or someone who had wanted to date her. Maybe a former coworker, either at Duggan's or another job she'd worked. The fact that Gina's purse wasn't found leads many to believe that she put her guitar in the trunk thinking she'd be back in a second, and when things changed for the worse, she couldn't get away. We still don't know, was the trunk left open or was the button on her keys hit? Could this have been done by Gina on purpose or accidentally? Or could her assailant have grabbed her keys away at which time the button was hit? Too bad it was the trunk button and not the panic button. No matter what way you slice it, there's no way in hell Gina was leaving her beloved guitar in an unlocked trunk if she had a choice in the matter. It seems pretty clear she was interrupted during the closing, which to me would suggest someone grabbed her or that the button was hit later. Purposefully or accidentally. Based on what Detective Sorensen has said, it seems quite clear police have someone in mind. Not only do they have someone in mind, they have someone that they believe they know committed this crime, but they lack the evidence to make an arrest. Sorensen stated that he continues to talk to this individual, that the individual knows he's a suspect. To me, that means you're looking at someone who lived in Lincoln or the nearby area. Someone who Sorensen would have the ability to pay multiple visits to for questioning and interviews without having to travel far away. How many people have you known in your life? I'm 38 years old and I couldn't give you a solid number, but I'd guess it has to be in the thousands. I'd lived in the same town for more than 20 years and there were few people I didn't know, either through their kids, through work, school, or sports, or maybe even just patronizing local businesses. Granted, Lincoln isn't a small town. But when you think about going to school there your whole life, working different jobs, performing in bars and clubs, making friends who introduce you to their friends, Gina probably knew a hell of a lot of people. Perhaps not all on a first-name basis, but likely through facial recognition. Who would she feel comfortable going to talk with that night? A guy she worked with? A woman she hung out with? Someone she dated a time or two? Someone who frequented Duggan's? Someone who knew her boyfriend or one of her ex-husbands? Maybe even the parent of one of her kids' friends. There's not a lot of people I'd get into a car with if I randomly ran into them, but taking a short walk to talk, yeah, I could see doing that. Maybe even someone who lived nearby. There's a lot of different possibilities, but the sheer fact that Gina would have possibly felt comfortable being alone with this person, to me, says it's probably someone that her friends would recognize, either by looks or by having heard the name. I suppose if we're going to look at someone she knew, then we've got to ask about motive. Why do this? Why abduct and murder Gina? Was it originally meant to go this way or did something go south? Unfortunately, people will kill over just a few dollars and friends can have dark sides you've never picked up on. So the motive doesn't necessarily have to be purely about murder. It could have been a number of different scenarios. Maybe a guy chats with Gina, starts getting aggressive once they're alone. She tries to fight him off and he loses it. Maybe he's been drinking that night or doing something else and isn't in his right state of mind. Either way, it could have been a situation that got out of control and wasn't necessarily premeditated as an abduction and murder. It could have been something simple, too. Maybe the person's talking to her and they go sit in the car and he starts the engine. Gina's like, hey, I gotta pick up Mike and get back to my kids, and this guy isn't having it. Or he's angry or he's jealous, and he just hits the gas. We know that up to that point in time, Gina had had some financial struggles. Maybe she owed someone money and they came to collect, but usually murdering the person you loan money to is a bad business model. Based on what Sorensen said, I feel like this isn't just someone Gina knew, but it's someone she knew well. Someone who, when being questioned, stood out. Whether he gave poor answers, seemed shaken, or behaved erratically, we don't know. But he did something that made police's eyebrows go up, and they started digging into him. Now, I'm no profiler, but my guess would be you're looking for someone who had some kind of a relationship with Gina in the past. Someone who saw her at the bar that night or knew she was going to be there in advance. Someone who has issues with women, especially strong-willed women, and who sees himself as being more attractive and charismatic than he truly is, and lashes out violently when his charms and attempts are rebuffed or denied. He's likely tied into the music scene somehow, either as a hanger-on or someone who's taken the stage but never really seen much success. He's likely also someone who knows the area well. Well enough to know where to put a body that for more than 20 years no one's been able to find. Within 10 miles of the bar, there's multiple campgrounds, lakes, isolated areas, wooded areas, a lot of places that someone could conceal a body without a great deal of effort, especially if they're familiar with those spots and which ones are popular versus which ones are visited less often. We don't have a name for a suspect, but we do know some of the men in Gina's life. The night she vanished, she encountered two, her boyfriend Michael Johnson and her ex-husband Dave Boss. According to everything we know, Gina and Dave had a good relationship, even after the divorce. They talked often and were very friendly with each other, and that night they chatted at the bar, catching up, and Dave congratulated Gina on her recent promotion. According to investigators, Dave left the bar before 11 that night, approximately 2 hours before Gina was abducted, and based on the fact that his name's never been mentioned again, he must have had an alibi for where he was at 1 a.m., or police haven't found any reason to look at him with suspicion. Then again, they've also been clear that everyone is a suspect and they've never mentioned ruling any person out. Then there's Michael, who puts an interesting spin on things. According to him, he's supposed to accompany Gina to the bar that night, but along the way changed his mind. This either caused a small argument or was the result of one, and led Gina to dropping him off at home with plans to pick him up later. It's been noted that Mike's home was approximately 10 blocks from the bar, which means he was anywhere between 1 and 1.5 miles away that night. While some of the families said they don't believe he was involved, there's a little hesitance from others. As Janelle put it in one of her interviews, it's hard not to be suspicious of everyone in this situation. Janelle said that she believes Mike had both taken and passed a polygraph test, though I've not found anything from law enforcement to confirm that one way or another. It would make sense he was the boyfriend. There'd been a spat between the two that night, so yeah, I could imagine wondering if maybe he went down there that night, saw Gina talking to a guy or someone else, and it made him angry and jealous. However, this is also a man who's been described as devastated in the aftermath, who himself went on Dateline to discuss the case and express his grief with the loss of the woman that he loved. He's also the guy who set in motion the search for Gina and the initial 911 call. Not really the behavior of a man who has been involved. I mean, he could have waited hours and not paged or called police until 11, 12, 1 o'clock. But he's on this at 6 a.m. He knows something's wrong. This isn't Gina. She doesn't just stay out without telling anyone. Hell, it's even noted that when he found Gina's car, he didn't touch it because he didn't want to disturb evidence. How easy would it have been to open the trunk and later, when your prints are found, say, yeah, I opened the trunk when we found the car. For a guy who could have covered things up and protected himself, he seems to have gone out of his way to be honest. He admits to arguing that night. He knows what that will imply to police, but he says it anyway. I've read in a few places that police don't consider him a suspect, but I haven't been able to confirm that. The Lincoln police are pretty tight-lipped about the suspects and persons of interest in this case, so I don't know that we'd get a direct answer even if we asked. So the truth is, the police were right from the beginning. Anyone could have done this, and everyone's a suspect. Detective Sorensen has a name, a face, someone he's looked in the eye and believes is responsible. He said it plainly. He knows this guy did it, and the guy knows that Sorensen knows that he did it. But he also knows there isn't enough evidence to arrest, so this guy gets to keep living his life, walking the streets, breathing the air, all of the things he stole from Gina. He can spend time with his family, raise children, listen to, and play music, things he ensured Gina never would be able to again. But he didn't just steal a mother, he didn't just steal a sister, he didn't just destroy 40 years of life. He robbed children of their mother and all the memories and wonderful times they could have had together after. He destroyed a family of 7 siblings who never imagined one of them would be gone so soon. He took Gina's dreams, he took her life that was just beginning to go her way, and he did it all for his own selfish, disgusting purposes. But he didn't kill her spirit, nor the spirit that her family continues to exhibit as they raise awareness, not just for Gina, but for so many missing persons. Here's the thing, and this is really important. There's a very, very slim chance that this guy hasn't said something to someone. Whether he was drunk, high, angry, sad, this guy has told someone what he's done, directly or indirectly. Someone in his life now or someone who has left his life knows what a monster he is, what he's capable of. As long as he's out there, on the streets, there's no denying the possibility that he could do this again to someone else. I couldn't stand by knowing someone like that was out there living his life a danger to everyone around him. I'd have to make a call. I'd have to tell someone. And that's all you need to do. Call in, give a tip, send an anonymous message. Tell them who did this. Tell them what you know. It's time for Gina's family to know the truth. It's time for them to find Gina, to give her a proper burial, to have some outlet for their grief and pain. Because if you know the truth and you choose not to speak up, you're just as responsible for everything they've gone through and will continue to go through. Sadly, without finding Gina, a legitimate tip, an outright confession, or the discovery of new evidence, the disappearance of Gina Boss will remain open, unsolved, and perhaps not as cold as we once believed. If you're looking for more information about the disappearance of Regina Boss, the Lincoln Star Journal has done the most extensive coverage, and this episode would not have been possible without their work. Gina's sister, Janelle, has done multiple interviews with news organizations and has appeared on the podcasts Unfound and Can I Help Find Your Missing Loved One? If you have any information about the disappearance of Regina Boss, please contact the Lincoln Police Department at 402-441-6000. You can also contact Nebraska Missing Persons Clearinghouse at 1-877-441-LOST. That's 1-877-441-5678. You can place a call to Nebraska Crime Stoppers at 1-800-422-1494. Or you can visit their website at NebraskaCrimeStoppers.com to submit a tip anonymously. You can also download the P3 Tips mobile app and submit tips anonymously. You can also go to 411Gina.org, the organization run by Gina's older sister who continues to search for her to this very day. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod. Message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Aurora K, Bacon Bits the Cat, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Dave Allen, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eric Sumpter, Guilherme Pinto, Heather Louise, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Marla Wright, Melissa Brekeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levonen, Sarah Mascaratolo, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, Tracy Woods, and Walter Jansen. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening, sharing the show, and helping keep these cases alive. I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.